Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have an amazing guest. You know, we have a founder that has been building, scaling, financing, something very exciting. You know, without a doubt, COVID gave them a really nice push. But we're going to be talking about all of the good stuff that we like to hear. You know, in this case, how they went ahead, you know, with being able to manage, you know, with the fast decisions, with crazy scaling. Also, they've raised close to $400 million. And they've also, you know, along the way, they've done a bunch of pivots. You know, basically, they listened and they adjusted themselves, you know, in order to really give, you know, folks what they needed. So I think that we have a very inspiring conversation ahead of us. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Roberto Cipriani. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Alejandro. Very happy to be here.
So originally, you obviously had your parents from Italy, but they immigrated to Canada and you ended up growing up in Montreal. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up?
Of course, I would say life growing up was pretty great. As you mentioned, grew up the son of Italian immigrants, came to Canada following the promise of better opportunities, as many immigrants have. And really from a young age, they instilled this importance of education to me and Tommy that I would say education is probably the greatest equalizer. Really that my education was a way to take a step forward that, you know, they didn't really have. So school was always important to me. I always put a lot of effort. I felt it was an honor to have the opportunities that I did to go to high school and university. Studied at McGill University here in Montreal, originally in physiology.
Quick question there, because I think that one thing that is incredible, you know, from your parents is the way that they instilled the education, you know, in you and the importance of education, seeing education as an equalizer. So why was education so important for them and what did they see that education could unlock for you?
I think, you know, being immigrants, not speaking the language, they felt it was a way for me to, like I said, take that step up, learn the language, better master the language, I would say, better than they wish they could, or they could have. And really it was, especially with that generation, if you put your time and effort in school, you'll get the most out of it with your career. I don't think that's the case anymore, by the way, and we could get that into that as a separate conversation. But really at that time, the combination of them being immigrants, wanting me to fit in, do the best that I can in school to really act as a springboard into my career and would allow me to do anything that I wanted with my career.
So obviously seeing them as immigrants, you know, working hard, seeing them going through their journey too. I mean, I'm an immigrant too in the U.S., so I really understand, you know, what it looks like. So how do you think that shaped who you are today, you know, seeing them going through that journey too?
I think that that's a great question. It really made me understand the value of hard work and perseverance. Being you're an immigrant yourself, when you're coming to a new country, there's a lot more than just the day to day that you need to do. You need to figure out how to speak the language. You need to, my parents were very young, so they did go to school, part of their schooling in Montreal here in Canada. But it's about fitting in. It's about understanding the culture. It's trying to hang on to your culture while you're learning a new culture. So for me, there's a lot more that goes on and a lot that they had to take on that I fortunately didn't have to put on my back. So I would say that for me, it all came down to hard work and perseverance. And that's something that I've held very closely. And still to this day, I think that a lot of the success that I have had, has come down to being perseverant through the hard times.
And you went eventually to McGill University, you know, an amazing university. And there, ultimately, that's what gave you the push to really understand that you eventually wanted to pursue a career in technology. So walk us through what were those sequence of events that kind of like propelled you in that career path.
Of course. So went to McGill originally to study physiology. Was really interested in academia. I feel like I've always been a scientist at heart, and went to grad school studying computational neuroscience. I was in the PhD program. I saw myself as being an academic. I would, you know, finish my PhD, go do a postdoc somewhere, and then move on to my own lab. During my time in grad school, I think I would say that I really enjoyed the computational part a lot more. What I mean by that was there's a lot of programming skills that I was developing, doing tons of data analysis, data science. Then I started to build the software that we needed to run the experiments. And I realized that, you know, that was where I felt the most fulfilled. It was in building the technology. It was in solving the complex problems, but using sort of code to express that. And I realized that, you know, as I dove into it more and more, I felt like academia was less and less what I wanted to do. And I decided to actually drop out of grad school and instead pursue a career in technology.
So tell us about what that looked like, because obviously for you, freelancing, you know, was a part of that journey. But eventually, you know, that freelancing, you know, got you in touch with Phil. And all of a sudden, you know, you become an entrepreneur. So walk us, how do you guys initially connect? What were some of the projects that you were doing earlier? And what were those synergies? How did they come together for Paper to be born?
Of course. As you mentioned, I was a freelance software developer. So I had a bunch of different clients, primarily based in Montreal, small to medium-sized businesses that needed some piece of technology to be built, whether it was a web app or something on the back end. I was introduced to my co-founder, Phil, through a mutual friend. Phil had a local in-home tutoring company here in Montreal. So as a parent, if you need somebody to come help your son with or daughter with math homework, you call this number and a tutor shows up to your house. And I was introduced to him because he wanted to build some technology in order to help scale the business to a certain extent. So we were introduced. We worked on and off together as myself as a freelance software developer and Phil as, you know, running this in-home local tutoring company for about, I would say, a year and a half. And then as our relationship started to develop and we were, you know, both excited with working with each other, Phil approached me with this idea of bridging the equity gaps that he was seeing in his classroom as a classroom teacher by using technology to provide support to these students who, you know, students who go home and maybe their parents are both working and their parents can't help them with their schoolwork, or, you know, parents that can't afford a private tutor to show up to your house 2 to 3 days a week. I knew that I wanted to help others in their educational journey because I felt that I was able to take so much from my educational journey that I felt like there was an opportunity there, and B, it felt like something that would fulfill me if we were successful. And we decided at that point we would start a company together and really, again, bridge these equity gaps that exist throughout our education system.
So ultimately, that was getting the academic support with tutoring and bringing it online. So when you're seeing stuff that is working or maybe that is not working offline, what is that the thought process of figuring out how you bring it in a digital, you know, kind of way and in a way that also scales? I mean, what were some of the things that you guys were looking at in order to, you know, make this thing happen?
Yeah. So originally you start simple, right? We were trying to take the offline in-home experience and bring it online, make it more affordable because now tutors don't have to travel to go see the students. They could do it from the comfort of their home, make it accessible. We were building out an online classroom with video conferencing, with a collaborative whiteboard, with file sharing. Let's not forget that this was in about 10 years ago in 2014. So video conferencing wasn't as popular, obviously, as it is today. So we just wanted to recreate that in-home experience online. But once you build an initial version, you quickly learn from listening to your customers what is best for them and what they're actually looking for.
So I guess for the people that are listening, what ended up being the business model of Paper? How do you guys make money today?
So we make money today primarily through selling paper or access to our platform directly to public school districts all over the U.S. The school district pays for it. That way, all students at this public schools or at these public schools have access to a tutor online 24/7. So it's really addressing those equity gaps. It doesn't matter how much money a student's family makes. If they are going to this X public school district, then they're getting access to academic support anytime that they need.
So I know that it was a process to obviously get to this point. You know, you guys definitely took a look at the market as you were moving along, whether it was 2015 on the way that you pivoted from video to chat, or, for example, the way that you guys were thinking about monetizing. How do you guys typically go about listening to what the market is looking for and adjusting yourselves to be able to do that? Because in many instances, you see companies failing to be able to do that because they are not able to do so effectively. So how does that work for you guys? How have you been effective at listening and implementing, you know, those insights?
That's a great question. I really believe it's all about time and market and being as close to the customer as possible. Originally, you referenced pivoting from video to chat. That's because we spoke to our tutors and our students every single day. Every time there was a tutoring session, we would ask the student, hey, what could have been better? Speaking to our tutors, how did you find the session? What could we have done better for you? And it was the same thing, and it still is the same thing today. It's all about having time in market, being close to the customer. Today, it's a little bit more complicated for us because our customer is the school district and the superintendent, but ultimately the end user is the student. But it's about spending time with the superintendent, it's about spending time with our students, but spending time with the teachers who are also users of Paper. And listening, when we say listen, it doesn't mean going there with your presumption of what they want. It's actually allowing them to share tough feedback and you listening to the feedback and creating that space where they feel comfortable sharing what they actually want. And once you get that information, it's about going back, filtering it, and giving that information to your team so then they can build what's right for your users.
So then, for example, in the case of monetizing, the way that you are pivoting perhaps features or experiences, I think maybe it's a little bit less nerve-wracking than pivoting a business model of how you're monetizing. I mean, initially you guys were going direct, you know, to, for example, like the before, you know, you were going to like the students or maybe like the teachers. Then you guys thought that it was better to go to institutions and schools, which tends to be probably like a longer sales cycle. And exactly. It's probably nerve-wracking going from like getting money quicker, then all of a sudden, you know, you're waiting, you know, rolling your thumbs. Oh my God, I hope this thing works out. So how did you guys go about making that adjustment? Because I'm sure that was not an easy one for you all.
That's a great question. And that part of that is listening to your customer. And it's when you're talking to schools and the superintendents recognizing that for them, one of their biggest initiatives is to better support their students and their communities. But part of that is also, we knew in order for us to succeed in our mission, that we would have to sell directly to public school districts. If we really truly wanted to bridge the equity gaps, even if we made paper and we, at one point, we were selling at a $15 a month for unlimited access to tutoring, selling it directly to parents and students, we still knew that that doesn't truly address the equity gap because there are still families that even $15 a month is a very hard sell because their money is going elsewhere into supporting their family. So for us, we felt it was a bit of pull from the market, but a little bit of push from us because we knew in order to ultimately address these equity gaps. We need to sell to the public schools. There's public education is funded very well throughout all of the US and in Canada. And we knew that speaking to the superintendents, there was an opportunity there. And we just felt really strongly that our solution was the best way to solve the problem of supporting their students and their communities.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
It sounds like also COVID changed everything. You know, it accelerated being able to achieve the vision that you guys were hoping or getting closer to that by a mile. And although that could sound very appealing, it's also very dangerous because you got to adjust yourself very quickly, you know, to things. And sometimes you make decisions without really having all the information that is needed. So what happened during COVID? Why did things change so rapidly for paper?
I would say the biggest reason was that overnight, district leaders understood how important it is to properly embed technology in their district. Pre-pandemic, and let's say March of 2020, about 65% of students in the US had access to a device through their school. And within 3 months or 4 months from March to July or August, that number increased to 95%. And then by the end of 2020, about 99% of students had access to a device through their school. And if you want to talk about being equitable, you need to ensure that all of these students have access to a device so they can then access the technology and the software and the services that are going to help them improve improve their academics and give them a better journey throughout their education as well. So it was really the investment of the technology and the infrastructure that, again, was a springboard for paper, because if a school did not adopt technology well, how paper could not be a success, right? We are a technology company selling access to a platform. So if students don't have access to a device, they're not going to access paper. So we knew that once we saw this like increased investment in the technology and infrastructure at the beginning of COVID, we felt, hey, this is going to be a really big opportunity.
So talk us about the fundraising too, because obviously, you know, you guys have raised quite a bit of money, close to 400 million, to be precise, 380 plus. So what was the journey of raising money? Because I know that especially at the beginning, you know, going through the A or the B was challenging. But walk us through how things, you know, and also expectations happen in that journey of going from one financing cycle to the next.
Yeah, I would say that financing for paper has always been a lot of work. And I don't say that in a necessarily a negative way, but it's never, fundraising has never been easy. And nor do I think it should be easy for any company. An example of that is for our Series A, we pitched, I think, 125 different funds, and we got one term sheet. But that one term sheet meant everything for the continued success of the company. Fundraising in our A was difficult. We needed to pitch a lot of different funds. I think the reason for us it was maybe a little bit more difficult was people always felt that EdTech was less sexy and, you know, long sales cycles, and it's hard to get into the districts and institutions. But once you started to get more and more proof points that we were able to actually sell into public school districts, the fundraising started to get a little bit easier. But early on, our seed, our Series A, our Series B, it was a lot of work. We had a whole CRM. We were, it took the majority of my time and my co-founder Phil's time in order to really make sure that we were meeting all the right people, having the right conversations, and then getting us to a term sheet.
So now that you obviously, you know, like have had your fair amount of lessons learned, you know, when it comes to fundraising, how do you go about, especially for all the folks that are listening now and wondering how they get this financings done, especially at an early stage, what would you say is the biggest lesson there on making sure that you have a process that is, you know, super streamlined, where you're very effective and you're not just throwing stuff on the wall, but being very intentional on the way that you're bringing investors and getting it done?
Yeah, I think you're alluding to it somewhere, but I mean, first of all, the story has to be there. Your storytelling, especially in earlier stages, you don't have, you know, 2-3 years of historical data to show investors. But I would say the second thing is you need to treat this like a very serious process. You need to ensure that you're following up at the appropriate times. You need to be direct and ask, hey, are you interested or not? Do you think this will go to a term sheet? One of the pieces of advice that I got that was super effective is at the end of every meeting, no matter which VC you're talking to, when are we meeting? Ask what the next step is and confirm the next step in that meeting. Or when are we meeting next? Is it with all the partners? Have a lot of clarity on the process. I think something that's interesting for, you know, Paper having started in Canada, it's just a difference in culture between VCs in Canada and the US. I think in the US, you can get a conversation with almost any fund, with at least some principal or partner at almost any fund, because VCs in the US don't want to miss out on the next opportunity. I think in Canada, it's slightly different, or there's not as much opportunity. But making sure that you're in the right conversations, networking and being involved in the startup communities wherever you're based to make sure that you know the right people, and then they'll introduce you to the other people and the other VC, etc. But ultimately, it comes down to process. The more disciplined you are in the process, the more success you have in raising capital.
So, Roberto, you go to sleep tonight. And you wake up in a world where the vision of Paper is fully realized. What does that world look like?
It's a world where every student feels supported throughout their educational journey, meaning whether they're stuck on a question that they're doing on their homework the night before it needs to be submitted, or they're studying for an exam that they have in a week. The idea is that we are supporting students and really bridging the gap between what schools provide and what students need to succeed.
So obviously here we're talking about the future, but I want to talk about the past with a lens of reflection, because, I mean, you guys have been at it, you know, for a while. You know, we're talking about a decade, right? A decade in startup compared to corporate is like 100 years, right? It's unbelievable. Now, let's say, you know, I was able to bring you back in time, maybe to 2013, 2014, where now you were bouncing around with Phil, you know, the possibility of creating something, right? And building something together. Let's say you were able to, you know, just show up into one of those meetings, maybe where you guys were like thinking about that future together, and maybe at one of those coffee shops there in Montreal, and you were able to just appear there, just sit down with those, say, younger, you know, selves. of you and Phil, and you were able to give the two of you guys one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
There would be two pieces of advice that I'd have to give. The first one is to persevere through every challenge. We have persevered, so I would feel like that's a less important piece of advice that I would want to give to my younger self or to a younger version of Phil. But it's definitely about persevering. If you truly believe in what you're doing, then it's going to be really hard and you don't want to quit a lot of the time. But if you really believe it, don't. I would say the second piece of advice, and one that I would more honestly give to my younger self, it's really important that you surround yourself by people that are better than you and really understand when you're not good at something. There are people out there that know that thing way better than you do. The earlier you bring those people in, the quicker you'll find success.
And just to double click on that, you know, I think that it's very difficult to be able to get to the point of really understanding that you don't know what you don't know, to be able to surround yourself by those people. So what does that process look like when you're like, my God, I definitely don't know this and I need someone, you know, to come in? And then how do you go about finding that someone? I mean, what have you learned in your own journey?
I think that we all, it's impossible to know what you don't know. But I feel that as entrepreneurs, we all have a bit of an instinct and we know somewhat deep down inside, almost subconsciously, that this area of the business, it's not really working out right now, but you just don't pay attention to it and you hope that it'll just survive through whatever change you're going through. I think it's a little bit about listening to that uncomfortable gut feeling a little bit earlier and saying, you know what, this probably means that I'm not understanding what needs to go on in this part of the business. Let me bring somebody in and that knows what they're doing and really help us accelerate in our growth. So it's not like there's a, there always is a moment in time when you realize it. But for me, I'm assuming for most entrepreneurs, it's always a little bit too late. I had that uncomfortable feeling for 3 to 4 months, but I didn't feel like I needed to address it until it's always just a little bit too late. It's really about as soon as you get that feeling, that probably is your subconscious trying to tell you, you need to be paying a little bit more attention here. And you probably don't know what you don't know. And so you just need to bring somebody in that does know.
So, Roberto, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Best way is on LinkedIn. You can find me. My name is Roberto Cipriani, and I'm available on LinkedIn. I'm very active, or try to be very active at least.
Easy enough. Well, Roberto, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an honor to have you with us.
It's been a pleasure. I really appreciate it. And thank you so much for having me, Alejandro.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.